Well, hey, good evening once again, one and all, from sunny Roswell, New Mexico. And by sunny Roswell today, I mean cool and windy. It's possible snow in the morning. It's been quite a bit nipply out this afternoon. Just not what you expect from living in the desert. No siree, let me tell you. But we have got two guests tonight, which is March 2nd, 2008, if you're listening live. And one is only for the next 20 minutes. So I'm going to skip on some of my usual top of the program, blah, 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 to make sure that we hear all we can from her. In about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Mark Pinkham, the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which means you'll have a chance to listen and speak with someone who is dedicated to sharing the mystical secrets of the Knight Templars. Ooh. But first, coming up right now, we have Angelia Joyner from Stephenville, Texas. Stephenville is where perhaps the most covered, by the media anyway, UFO sightings in recent history occurred. And Angelia is the reporter who interviewed everybody involved and brought this entire event to national attention, and who was recently dismissed from her position at the local paper for her ongoing involvement with investigating and reporting on this UFO sighting. And now she works with a new website detailing everything that's known about the Stephenville sighting. So Angelia, welcome to the program tonight.
Hi, and it's Angela. The I is just there to throw you off.
Okay, and it did. It worked. Your clever plan worked.
It worked.
Angela, well, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm really excited to be talking with you. The event that's been around, you're right, it has received quite a bit of media coverage.
I think it's probably the credibility of the witnesses involved that has brought so much attention to this. But would you mind just recapping for us first, in case there's one or two people in our 30 or 40,000 who don't know what's going on with this? Could you just recap the whole saga of the Stephenville UFOs?
Okay, the first call that I received was from Steve Allen. He's a pilot, and he's also a business owner. His businesses are in Glen Rose, Texas, not too far down the road, probably about a 50-minute drive. And he was with three other people, and they witnessed something in the sky that none of them could explain. It flew over and had horizontal lights that reconfigured into two sets of vertical lights, turned into a dirty burning flame, and shot off. And about 10 minutes later, it came overhead again, but this time it looked as if it were being pursued by two F-16 jets. So after on that story, we published Steve's phone number, and he began getting calls, and so did I. We continued to get more and more people calling and saying, look, I saw the same thing, and things escalated from that point. At first, the Naval Air Station in Fort Worth said they did not have any F-16s in the area. And then 2 weeks later, they came out with a press release saying there were actually 10 F-16s over Erath County from the hours of 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. on January the 8th. And, of course, that brewed some conspiracy theories, and things have just been ongoing ever since.
Well, the fact that the F-16s were sighted, that came out early, and then it was later in the game that the military finally admitted, after saying no, there was nothing there, that yes, there was. Is that right?
Yes, it took 2 weeks for them to issue the press release that said they had made an error.
Oh, wow, and they were saying, like, we don't even know if they saw anything. That's interesting. I think that second part of the story, the government admitting to, well, we were wrong, there was something there, is what brought it to Larry King's attention. Because he did two programs on this whole series of events, right?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that might have had something to do with it. I think they were already looking at it, but that probably brought everything to the forefront.
How many of the, you published articles, you were the reporter for the Stephenville paper. What's the name of the newspaper?
It's the Stephenville Empire Tribune.
Okay. Okay, and how many articles on these UFO sightings did you personally publish?
I think we did about, let's see, one, two, maybe seven, six or seven, yeah.
Wow, and I've read that recently now a third police officer has come forth as a witness, too. Is that correct?
That's right. Just a couple of days ago, I posted on StephenvilleLights.com an account from Mike Zimmerman, and he's a former protector of Texas governors. He protected five Texas governors over 19 years through the Department of Public Safety. The last governor he protected was George W. Bush, and he witnessed something at his home he couldn't explain, and we just did a story on that for the website.
Yeah, I've read that. Now that you've published, you're like probably the main local media contact. Is that right?
That's right.
So you were the one.
If people can find me. You know, some people don't know that I'm not at the newspaper. One man here said, Angela, it's sort of funny that the whole world seems to know you're not at the newspaper except for your hometown.
Oh, locally they don't know that you're not even there anymore?
Yeah, locally I don't think it's gone around as much as it has nationally.
That's funny.
Well, of course, the newspaper's not going to print anything about it, so.
Well, what I read a little while back ago was that the newspaper dismissed you, saying that people weren't interested in UFO stories now. Is that how it really panned out, or what?
I had already given my notice because I had been asked to ignore UFO phone calls and emails, and I really had no way to do that, and I didn't want to abandon the witnesses. You know, they thought that the readership was ready to go in a different direction, and I tried to honor that request, but it just wasn't possible. I was still receiving so many phone calls and so many emails, and I tried to direct that attention to after hours or on my lunch hours so that I would not be using newspaper time to deal with those. And apparently that wasn't the right thing to do either. I was 1 week into my 2 week notice, and I was asked to pack my things and go.
Fired for quitting then.
Yeah, maybe that's what you would call it. Some people have asked me, well, were you fired? And I said, well, I guess it just depends on your definition of fired.
But you were still wanting to write and deal with the UFO story, apparently, right?
Well, I didn't want to abandon those witnesses, and there was still a lot of things going on. And plus, I was still the media contact. There was still a lot of media. The very day that they told me to leave, I had a lunch appointment with a writer from the Dallas Morning News, and he was wanting to do a follow-up story on the impact the sightings had had in the community. And there was many, many people like that. You know, they wanted to keep writing about it, and I was their main contact. And it was very difficult just to ignore those phone calls or ignore those emails, as I was instructed to do.
So you're doing it after hours, lunch break and stuff like that, and they still just didn't like that?
That's what I was trying to do. Yeah, I was just trying to. They wanted to go back to the normal coverage of school board meetings and local town news, and I was trying to do that, but it was very frustrating. I think that a story of that magnitude actually drains a small newspaper's resources. At the time that story hit, I was the only full-time reporter, and I had other duties, you know, but I was expected to have two front-page stories a day, plus two weekend full pages that I was to gather information for. And during that media frenzy, those things, well, actually, I was lucky to get one story on the front page.
So, all the attention that the whole rest of the world was paying to the UFO sightings actually dragged you down on being able to do your job, just your normal day-to-day grind.
Exactly.
And I guess whenever the Dallas Morning News and all the other papers are calling you for information, they're not paying your salary, are they?
That's right.
We're offering, yeah, yeah. I'm not getting paid for this, and I wasn't offering to pay you either. That's just, oh, that's so crazy how such a labor of love it is. Before all this happened, would you have considered yourself a believer in UFOs, or did you have any interest in them?
I would say that my attitude about UFOs in the past was passive. I really didn't think much about it one way or the other, except if I saw something on television, I found it interesting. If I read something in a magazine, I found that interesting. But I didn't really feel one way or the other.
Okay. So what has this coverage, the fact that you've talked to all the witnesses, we've got a pilot, a police officer, a peace officer, a constable. That's like saying police officer, isn't it? The peace and...
It's similar, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now that you've heard their stories, what do you have any guess? Or, you know, I guess you've been closer than anyone on the story that wasn't actually seeing it. Do you have any guess of what you or some of the local townspeople are saying? What was the actual origin of the craft?
Nobody really knows what the origin of the craft is. That's the question that everyone would like answered. I have seen some video that's really astonishing.
And that's on your website,
I have seen these witnesses. I've seen their lives change. Probably there are some of them that will continue all of their lives to try to see it again, to try to find out what it was.
I know from reading some of the reports that MUFON made a little flurry, or the Mutual UFO Network, they sent investigators there to do their own independent review and survey of the witnesses and stuff like that. Did you cover any of that when they were there?
Yes, I've been to both of those meetings.
Okay.
The first one was huge, probably had about 400 people, but probably just as many media people as witnesses. But I know that Steve Hudgens, the lead Texas investigator, brought 50 witness forms and ran out. So there were quite a few people that showed up to give their reports to MUFON. And then the second meeting was held this month, and this is March. It was held in February, and media was cautioned, you know, not to attend. And, you know, some media did show up, and if they didn't have cameras, then they were allowed in. But mostly local media, and still that day they ended up with 17 more witnesses.
So people coming forward because they feel safer, because it's, well, everybody's seen it. I won't be considered a kook.
I think so. And, you know, the thing that I keep hearing over and over from people are, you know, they're very appreciative that I did the story as a straight news story with no little green men mentions or flying saucer mentions or... things like that. So, and that is how I reported it. I just did it as a straight news story, and I thought it was interesting. And I think the fact that those first two stories involved 8 witnesses, and they were well-known community members. One man's name is David Jaquist. He has been a member of this community ever since I can remember. I'm 46 years old, and he's a home builder here, and he's well respected. The constable is an elected official. He is voted into office by the people of Erath County.
Wow.
It's unusual for an elected official to come forward simply because they're worried about the next election most of the time. And the credibility of the witnesses brought out witnesses by the dozens.
So a ton more people. We're well over 50 witnesses that you've heard of or dealt with then, right?
Well, there's more than 100 now.
Wow. And how many of them do you know offhand? Because I remember you said F-16s were reported by some. Is that common? Did a lot of people see that?
Well, not a lot of people saw... Only 4 people saw the F-16s chasing are what appeared to be pursuing the object. But many people noticed the increased air traffic that evening, and I would say the next week. Even I noticed the transport helicopters were just thick around here. There were a lady sent me pictures from I-20 on Interstate 20 on her way home from Fort Worth that evening, and you could still see the contrails in the air, and it was definitely a grid pattern. And she was with her son, and there were so many planes. When she emailed me, she said, we were worried that one of them or a couple of them were going to run together. There were so many. So it's been an amazing amount of military traffic. Now, I would say that has slowed down now, but that first week, there was a lot.
That's pretty interesting because all the military activity, I'm reminded of an article I read that was published by a UFO researcher, and he had an angle that, to my knowledge or his, none of the media had ever picked up on, was that your county, and more specifically your airspace, is very close to or bordering on the restricted airspace of President Bush's camp there. Is that right?
That's right, but President Bush wasn't there. He was out of the country on the night of January the 8th, is my understanding.
Okay, but I guess anything, especially if it were unknown and moving fast, that would be flirting with, perhaps in or at least along the edges of that airspace, that would be a huge military deal, I'm sure, right?
Well, some people have speculated that. I have heard that from more than one. But the impression that I got after reading and things, it's more when he is actually there. He's there for short periods of time. I think he's there this weekend, but like only a couple of days at a time. And I think that's when they're more interested in what goes on there.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just the impression of anything flying through restricted airspace, or at least nearby it, that would get a little military attention. And it was just, I found it surprising that there wasn't any media mention of that, but I guess, like you said, it's because he wasn't there. It just wasn't a big deal.
Right. I think that's why. And another thing, that same press release that the Naval Air Station released, he said that we were in the Brownwood Military Operating Area, or Brownwood MOA, as it's referred to, and we're not. And it took maybe 30 minutes for pilots to start coming into my office and saying, hey, if we're in that Brownwood Military Operating Area, it's news to us. Here's our maps. We have the most recent maps available. The airspace that he's referring to is a minimum of about 14 miles from Stephenville, which it does sit right on the western edge of Dublin, Texas. But Stephenville and the Selden area are not included in that.
Why would they lie, or why would they be wrong about that? What's the big deal there?
Well, you know, that's what I thought, too, we already had them say they didn't have any F-16s in our area. And then 2 weeks later, they said, oh, we made a mistake. We had 10 in the area. And then it said, you know, over that Erath County Military Operating Area. So maybe those planes strayed out of that area. I'm not sure. Now, to go from the Naval Air Station to that area, they would definitely fly over us, but they wouldn't stay in our area is what I'm thinking.
After MUFON was there, have they made an official statement then on their version or what they think went on down there?
No. MUFON is still gathering reports, and you know, it was just like a week ago that they got 17 more reports. So they're plotting out the sightings on a map, and they've also sent Freedom of Information Acts to the FAA, and they're still compiling their information. I believe that they will give a preliminary report in April, I'm not sure if it'll be a final report. It takes quite a while to compute all of that data. It's an incredible amount of work. And those men are volunteers, but most of them, some are retired, but most of them have regular 8-to-5 jobs, you know, or whatever they do, you know, to earn a living. So they have to do it in their off time.
Okay, we got like 2 minutes left until we break. I was one, you've told me that you do have a new job already, so thank God for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you're also working on the new website, StephenvilleLights.com. What's tell us about that or promote it. What you got going on there?
Well, actually, Steve Allen and a couple of the other witnesses had already begun that website, but went at my sudden departure on the from the newspaper, they sort of sped things up so I would have a place to write. So it's a place for me to put my stories, and we're trying to gather more information and videos and things like that to get on there. It's been a slow process. The first day it was up was February the 10th, so it's still kind of in its infancy.
But you do have a video of what one person captured. Was that on a cell phone?
Ricky Falls has a cell phone video of a daytime sighting. He's the only one that has seen the craft in the daytime. Leroy Gayton has nighttime footage, but it's kind of been tied up in red tape. We're working on some other footage. It's just taken a while to get it all together.
And if anybody wants to check out, I noticed you've got a really neat art card there, a commemorative good piece of artwork.
Oh, yeah.
On the whole event.
I'm really, really proud of that. That was designed by Mark Medford. I think he's a wonderful, talented artist in Maine. Pretty soon we're going to have on the site a free wallpaper that you can download that he also designed. There's only going to be 250 produced. And right before you called, I was sitting here signing them.
Yeah, I see. They're signed by the artist and by you, the other famous person involved. Good. Well, it's StephenvilleLights.com. Thanks, Angela Joyner, for at least catching us up. And I hope there's not too much conspiracy behind your newspaper firing. But it sounds pretty straight. It's like they just want to get away from it in general. That was
right.
My concern earlier. We're going to have a little music. Blondie's my MySpace featured artist of the week, and we'll be back after this break, about 4 or 5 minutes, with Mark Pinkham. And this is Guy Malone. Thanks again very much, Angela, for joining us. Good luck and
thank
God bless
you
on your new career too.
Thank you.
You bet. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Welcome back once again to Live from Roswell. You can get that link to our previous guest, Angela Joyner. She's the reporter who covered all the Stephenville UFO sightings. And her articles and some pictures and video from that event all are linked from the top of www.livefromroswell.com, as well as a link to the website of our upcoming guest, Mark Pinkham. He is the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars. I am your host, Guy Malone, and we do this every week via the Paranormal Radio Network, reaching about 40 to 50,000 listeners all over the globe on every live broadcast. And nearly every one of those listeners is of well above average intelligence, and they've got money to burn. So if you have a product, an event, or a service you'd like people to be hearing about during the program, visit livefromroswell.com and click on the link near the top that mentions audio, commercial, and banner ad opportunities. And hey, an event I'm going to be at, if you are anywhere near the Joshua Tree, California area, the third annual Retro UFO Conference is just the way to kick off your springtime. It's billed as not your typical UFO conference in that it recaptures the, happier atmosphere from the 1950s and 60s UFO lore, and it takes place near Giant Rock at the Integraton, built by George Van Tassel from designs, I'll say allegedly, given to him from space aliens. It's www.retroufo.com has the whole lineup of speakers, including a few you may have heard on this program at one time or another, including Nick Redfern, Greg Bishop, and Adam Gorightly. I will be there myself as your silver-faced MC for at least one of the days. And don't look now, but George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM is also scheduled to be there in person. It's all happening in April 26th and April 27th. So you can visit www.retroufo.com and make plans to have some fun. Dressing up in your favorite space outfit from the 60s is indeed encouraged at this event. Tonight, our guest, I'm going to read his bio, is Mark Pinkham, the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which is a division of the Scottish Knight Templars, dedicated to reviving and sharing the mystical secrets of the Knights Templar. Our International Grand Prior is Ian Sinclair of Clan Sinclair, the builders of Rosslyn Chapel, which contains on its walls and within its crypt many of the Templar mysteries. Some of the topics up for discussion tonight are going to be why the Knights Templars were originally formed, the Holy Grail, the secrets of Rosslyn Chapel, and you can join in with us by calling us toll-free. Well, we do not have a toll-free number tonight. We have moved the studio, Joe tells me. Sorry about that. But if you have a question for Mr. Pinkham and you want to contribute to this discussion, you can send a question via email to me at talktome, T-A-L-K-T-O-M-E, at livefromroswell.com. And that email address is posted on livefromroswell.com. And let me start by saying thank you very much, Mark, for rescheduling tonight after our producer had some technical issues last week. But welcome to the program, sir.
Yeah, thank you. This is great. I don't care when I get on, but I'm just glad to be on.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting discussion, I'm sure. I want to ask first, is Mark the best way to address you, or do you have a title that most acquaintances are in, I guess, in better form?
I'm fine with Mark.
Okay, yeah. No His Holiness or anything like that
necessary. No.
Got it. I'll jump in, and again, listeners can email me if they want to ask a question about the Knights Templar, Rosslyn Chapel, the Holy Grail, and topics along these lines. We'll find out more. I'll jump in with the first question. I just want to know, from your bio, tell us, please, about Rosslyn Chapel, like what it is and what's supposed to be hidden there.
Well, that's a big question.
We got 20 minutes at least.
All right.
For it.
It might take every second of that. Well, to understand Rosslyn Chapel, it's believed that you have to go back to the very beginnings of the Templars and why they were formed. A lot of people speculate that they were formed in order to police the Holy Land and protect the pilgrims coming and going, the Christian pilgrims. Well, if you look at the situation, if you look at the fact that there was only 9 knights and they're all middle-aged, and that's the way it was for the first 9 years of the order, you know, there's not a lot of territory that they can cover. So
true.
Obviously there is more to that story, and sure enough, we know that there is. As it turns out, the Templars were formed in order to, well, initially to excavate and dig around the ruins of Solomon's temple, which actually at that time was Herod's temple, because Solomon's temple had ceased to exist, you know, hundreds of years before that.
Solomon and Herod of the Bible, right?
Right, but Herod apparently built his temple as a model or as a version of Solomon's temple. So, I mean, they're pretty much the same. But nonetheless, that's where Solomon's temple was and originally. And so they were digging around these ruins, and in some places they dug down as much as 20 feet. And after 9 years, they had, you know, a lot of treasures that they had found. A lot that they had excavated, but there was also a lot of documents that they had acquired, too, because they were initiated into a lot of different sects and orders and organizations, and through those sects they acquired a lot of esoteric and, at that time, very heretical documents. And then after 9 years, it said that they left with 5 huge trunks full of treasures and documents. And then they wandered up through Europe and into Scotland. And those five trunks, it said they originally ended up in Kilwinning, which was the original lodge, Freemasonic Lodge of Scotland. And they were there for some time, and then they were taken to Roslyn Castle. That was where the Earls of Sinclair Earls lived. And then for quite a number of years, they remained in Roslyn Castle. And then there was a big fire in Roslyn Castle, and it said almost to the day, 6 months later, they started building Roslyn Chapel. So it appears as though that might be the main reason that they built Roslyn Chapel. Ground scans within the last 20, 30 years have shown that there is, lo and behold, there is five big cases down there. And and so, of course, ever since, you know, the ground scan revealed them, you know, everyone is busily speculating, well, what is in those boxes? And we all have our own ideas, but one thing we're pretty sure about, that there's some very hardcore heretical documents about a lineage that the Templars were initiated into. This is a Johannite lineage that is said to have been passed from John the Baptist to Jesus to John the Apostle, and then down a line of Grand Masters, all named John, until the time of the Templars, when the Grand Mastership of that lineage passed to our first Grand Master, Huda Payans, and from that point on, we were the guardians of that lineage. And within that lineage, it was so much heretical theology and heretical belief.
Let me ask you, heretical by what standards?
Well, by Catholic Church.
Okay.
Right.
So,
for example, the belief was that John the Baptist was co-Messiah with Jesus, but not only that, he was actually kind of one rung above Jesus because he was the guru to Jesus, the teacher of Jesus, and he was also the founder of the whole Gnostic tradition in the West. So this is the kind of wisdom you have. Well, we know that a lot of the documents had this kind of wisdom because when the Templars took the trunks up into Europe, they stopped off in a place called Omer, which is in Flanders at the time. And because one of the original nine knights, Geoffrey of Omer, came from there, so they wanted to stop off there. And while they were there, there was a cleric called Lambert Omer, and he apparently copied over one of the documents they had in the trunk. Well, that document or that copy that he made is today it's filed away in the library of the University of Ghent in Belgium, and it's an illustration. It represents the heavenly Jerusalem. And this is what this illustration represents. Well, those that have studied the illustration say that that Jesus is nowhere to be found, and John, according to the document or the illustration, is to be the Messiah that will found the New Jerusalem. Well, that's the New World. And that was the tradition, that it was going to be a Messiah that was going to come and initiate, you know, the new era, the New World. Well, according to this document, it was John the Baptist. And that was Templar belief, that it was, you know, John was, like I said, one rung above Jesus. He was the founder of that lineage, and the most prized possession that the Templars ever had supposedly was a mummified head they called Baphomet, which was the head of John the Baptist. And they found this in Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade. They brought it back to Europe, and then there was the second in command after Jacques de Molay. He is said to have carried this from preceptory to preceptory wherever there was a significant initiation going on. And apparently that head emanated the same kind of power, that Holy Spirit power it did when it was on the body of John the Baptist. So if you were in the presence of that head, that energy would enter you, and it would have kind of dramatic alchemical spiritual effects on your being. And that's, you know, that was what the initiation was all about. It would actually evolve you very rapidly in a spiritual way.
Is that head part of what's possibly under the crypt still?
Yes, exactly. Well, one of the beliefs is that the Roslyn Chapel is the headquarters, if you will, of that whole Johannite lineage, and the Gnostic wisdom of the Templars came through that Johannite lineage, and that's what you find encoded inside Roslyn Chapel. All those images, they all represent that Gnostic wisdom, and the documents and the treasures associated with that Gnostic lineage is believed to be hidden in the crypt. So, you know, it's kind of like the like I said, the headquarters of that Johannine line, even the home of John the Baptist, because John the Baptist he was venerated because of his power, his energy, his this Holy Spirit power, and Roslyn Chapel was built as a miniature Gothic cathedral. It was built according to sacred geometrical principles in order to generate the Holy Spirit power. It was to use for initiation purposes and for healing. And so it's supposed to, you know, generate the same kind of power that emanated from John, or what was transmitted from John when he was alive. So in a way, it's kind of a monument to John, the Johannite tradition, and the Gnostic wisdom of the Templars.
So it's kind of, do you follow that belief that his head and power are kept underneath or inside of a crypt, under the...
Well, you know, I don't know if I subscribe to the belief that his head is there, but I do subscribe to the belief that embodies the Gnostic wisdom and the Gnostic power that the Templars acquired through that Johannite lineage. I do believe that.
So who alive today is still of that lineage?
Well, you see, what happened after 1307, when there was a mass arrest of the Templars, bit by bit over the years, much of the Gnostic wisdom and power was kind of expunged from the Templars, and then there was kind of a division where a lot of different sects of Templars grew up, but most of these sects were more of a military nature, or Freemasonic. The biggest Templar sect today is the Commandery of the York Rite of Freemasonry, and there's like 200,000 of these Knight Templars of the York Rite. And then you have the SMOTJ, which is mainly retired and active military. But they're not interested in the Gnostic wisdom of the Templars. In fact, the SMOTJ actually believes that the Templars were founded to protect pilgrims coming going from the Holy Land. You know, even though, you know, all the evidence points otherwise, that's what they believe, which is fine. But what happened to that Gnostic wisdom? It went a couple different places. One, it went to become part of what's known as the Apostolic Johannite Church, which is a small church, but there are a few of these churches in different cities, mainly in North America, U.S. and Canada. Very small church, though. And then the other Gnostic wisdom and power belief is that it mainly landed up with the Sinclair clan, as did these treasures or these Gnostic documents.
That's a last name, correct? The Sinclair,
yeah.
It's not an appellation. Okay.
Right. So, you know, they were the St. Clairs in France, and then they became Sinclairs in Scotland. The tradition is that Hugh de Payens married into the St. Clair line by marrying Catherine de St. Clair, and from that point on, the destinies of the Templars and the St. Clairs were interconnected, and this is why those five boxes ended up in Roslyn Castle when they did, you see. Basically because, you know, Hugh de Payens and the Templars were so closely connected to the Sinclairs, and It's even said that during the time of the demise of the Templars, 1307, most of them escaped and went up into Scotland with their treasures. And the Inquisition wasn't able to get a hold of their treasures. And soon after they arrived in Scotland, the Sinclairs became amazingly wealthy. Right? They all traveled with these huge entourages. They built castles all over Scotland. And I don't know how true it is, but you know, the legend is they dined on gold plates and so forth and so on. And so it appears as though, in not only those original five trunks, but all the later treasures and documents of the Templars also ended up with the St. Clairs. And the, of course, you know, the St. Clairs, if you study their tradition, their lineage back into France, you'll find that they are very much connected to the Gnostic tradition. In fact, they even helped and created the Cathar movement. These were the heretical Gnostics that were basically exterminated by the Catholic Inquisition. And so from the very beginning, they were always connected to the Gnostic path, the Gnostic wisdom, to preserve the Gnostic wisdom. And so this seemed to have continued, you know, after 1307, that so much of the Gnostic wisdom and rites ended up with the St. Clairs. And what happened to so much of it, of course, is that it became encoded in Roslyn Chapel, you know, that was built by the St. Clairs, and then the documents were put into the crypt underneath.
So, like, there's a lot of symbology in the walls. This is the same chapel that was in the movie Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but I'm not really basing that as a true story or anything.
Right. Well, what's interesting, I just wanted to mention, is that you don't find another chapel or church, small church, in the world like Roslyn, where you've got so many green man heads. You've got, like, inside and outside, there's more than 100. And so why was there this incredible veneration for Green Man, right? Well, according to one tradition, the whole Gnostic tradition, the Gnostic path, started many thousands of years ago. It started with the goddess tradition, right? And her son was the preserver of her mysteries, and he was the Green Man. So essentially, he was the founder of the Gnostic tradition, and so it makes sense, certainly, that you would find him represented in Roslyn Chapel, which is built as a monument to the Gnostic path.
Is this Green Man would you call him human, or is he like a minor deity, alien, or?
No, he's actually Yeah, that's another big question.
You know, this is live from Roswell, so as soon as you talk about little green men, that's
all right. Well, I mean, since it is live from Roswell, the tradition is about this green man, that he was originally extraterrestrial origin, and that he came from someplace else, and a lot of this wisdom we have about him came from Westerners who traveled around the Far East, and they studied the records, and they learned directly from the holy people and the monks and so forth, and a lot of them said that he'd come from someplace else. A lot of them said he came from Venus, for example, and then some also said that he came from the Pleiades, but he was the first teacher of spirituality on the planet, which was the Gnostic path, and some say that he was the leader of the Sons of God, and that they all came to teach, you know, the Gnostic path, or which was part of the goddess tradition, which is why in the Book of Enoch you find that the sons of God taught the daughters of men different elements of the goddess tradition, such as gemology, healing,
metal,
divination, and also alchemy.
Herbs and roots.
Yeah, exactly, right. Right. That's
so
what
it goes
what
back that him. Far, then. This Roslyn Chapel, if I'm not mistaken, or putting words in your mouth, it's very possible that this is essentially a church built to an extraterrestrial, or at least to commemorate the ongoing teaching of an extraterrestrial.
Well, Yes, and you, I mean, you're not going to find people, many people, that are going to concur with that. You know, I'm a little bit radical in a way because I've actually taken back this Johannite line that the Templars were initiated into much further than anybody else has that I know of. And what you find is that John the Baptist was part of the Mandean lineage of Gnostics. The Mandeans are the only surviving Gnostic sect on the planet today. They live in southern Iraq. And according to their tradition, they came from Sri Lanka. And they brought the Gnostic teachings west, and then they became part of the Persian, the Egyptian, Sumerian. And finally, they became a branch of the Essenes known as the Nazareans or the Nazarenes. And it was in that sect that John the Baptist and Jesus were born. Well, on Sri Lanka today, Sri Lanka is one of the main holy places, sacred sites for this Gnostic master that is said to have founded the original Gnostic path. And he has many names to him. On Sri Lanka, he's known as Skanda, Murugan, Kartikeya. And on Sri Lanka today, you've got a temple site where you've got Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims all worshiping him, this same being. Because he's actually an important being in all three traditions. Although he's called something different in these traditions, he's the same being. And so you don't find that really at any place else in the world. Now, what's interesting is that Sri Lanka, according to the Muslims, is the original Garden of Eden. It's where it all started, where all religion started, where all Gnosticism started, right? And so conceivably, you know, this being, you know, was somehow connected to the Garden of Eden and started all, you know, the all spiritual tradition, you know.
Interesting. We're just seconds away from taking a break. We've got a whole hour coming up with Mark Pinkham, and you can email me at talktome@livefromroswell.com if you'd like to pose a specific question. I know when we return, we'll be talking about the Knights Templar in any relationship to Freemasons or the Illuminati, the future of Roslyn Chapel. I'm going to be asking you if it's going to be opened up and, you know, why is it being kept secret still. And maybe we'll get into a little secret society stuff and see how what we're talking about does or does not relate to that. We'll be back just after a commercial. Right now, my MySpace artist is Blondie, and this will be fun to listen to. It's a new twist on a song that you think you know, but it's a little different coming up, and then we'll be back after a commercial. Join us back again on Live from Roswell momentarily. Welcome back again to Live from Roswell. I'm your host, Guy Malone, broadcasting globally over the Paranormal Radio Network, and we're continuing our conversation with Mark Pinkham, the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars. His website is linked from livefromroswell.com, and my email address, too, is talktome, T-A-L-K-T-O-M-E, at livefromroswell.com. If you'd like to chime in with a question or comment for Mark, we're discussing the Knights Templar, the Roslyn Chapel that was built to conceal or has a crypt, maybe some treasures underneath it. And we're getting into some of the topics of the secret, I guess you'd call it a secret society. That is a question I want to ask you, Mark, if you don't mind. I think most people, when they think of Knights Templar and a lot of the topics you've been talking about, they consider that a secret society. How is it now that you have a website and you're coming out to promote and talk more about these things?
Well, I think that you're going to find these days that the Templars are most definitely not a secret society. The SMOTJ, the Commandery, the various Templar sects in Scotland, they're wide open. They're not secretive at all. I mean, obviously, the Templars, when they started out, had to be secretive because they were representatives of the Johannite sect, and they taught a lot of heretical teachings and were involved with heretical practices. So for that reason, they had to be secretive. But
by heretical, you mean the Catholic Church is calling them that. You're not
right.
Calling,
right.
You're not saying okay.
Right.
So they didn't.
But actually, today, you know, so many of the Templar sects are their membership are probably are mostly Christians. You know, they're anything but heretical. I mean, I guess if you had to, you know, compare them, we're probably the most heretical, you know, of the sects. But we have no reason to be secretive. We believe that the world is at a threshold where it's time for people to wake up, to develop this Gnostic awareness, to move away from the dogmatism, this kind of crystallized dogma that they've been force-fed to believe, and have their own direct personal experience. And that's always been part of the Goddess tradition, is to be able to go out and have your own experience and create and cultivate, have your own communication and experience of God, and so you can be informed, you can be communicated to from spirit in a way that's best for you. All dogmatic traditions start out as a Gnostic going out to find his or her truth, and then coming back and having his truth become dogmatized and made into a religion so that everybody had to have the same experience, right? Well, that was okay. Never part of the Goddess tradition. You were allowed to go out and have your own experience and come back and share the wisdom that you received and never, without ever having to worry about being burned at the stake because your experience was different from somebody else's. And so we believe that this is the point we're at now, that everyone deserves to go out and have their own personal experience without being told what they have to believe, because we believe that totally stunts a person's evolution. They're not able to develop their faculties of intuition. They're not able to tap into this fount of knowledge that exists within everyone's own heart. And this is the belief in the East, you know, that when you're evolved, you can directly tap in to this wisdom so that you know who you are, who you've been, what this universe is about, everything, without anyone ever having to tell you a thing. And this is why they say, well, John the Baptist, he was the founder of the Gnostic tradition in the West. He exemplified by his life who and what a Gnostic is. He went off into the wilderness, you know, without any books, certainly without pen and paper, without anything. And he lived, you know, on locusts and honey and by himself in the woods. But he was full of wisdom all the time. He didn't need anyone to teach him anything. You know, he just found it within himself. And that's the true life of a Gnostic. And this is the life of the great masters in the East today. They don't need anybody to teach them. Even the gurus today that supposedly are leading us on the spiritual path, if you go to a true guru, the guru never says anything to you. You just hang out with the guru, and because of the spiritual energy that's emanating from that guru into you, you start getting in touch with your own wisdom. You start opening up your own Gnostic centers and your own Gnostic wisdom, and it all comes to you without the guru ever saying one word to you. But, you know, the people that created these dogmatic paths were not Gnostics themselves. They were disciples and followers of a Gnostic, but they didn't have the Gnostic experience themselves. So they were trying to identify and translate and interpret the original this Gnostic experience of the original teacher without having it themselves, you see.
Yeah, does your understanding of Gnosticism related to John the Baptist, is what's recorded, I guess, New Testament-wise, that even though he went out to the wilderness, he had a message of repentance from sin and that the kingdom of heaven is coming. Do you have a different message? Because he was very, I would say, God of Israel, God of Isaac and Jacob, and repent from sin. Is that a typical Gnostic, or is that something that you guys still affirm?
Well, you know, the Course of Christians will say that he was the wayshore, if you will, the advance crew, whatever, for Jesus. But the Gnostics say no. What he was saying was that the kingdom of God was coming to the planet is what he was saying, it wasn't, he was saying that he was preparing the way for the Lord, which was God in general. It wasn't a specific person or Messiah. It was God in general.
Okay, that's
so he was like saying, prepare your way so that you can become one with God. You can know God. And his way of doing preparing you was through the baptism, which, see, according to the Mandeans, John the Baptist was a Mandean, and he learned the baptismal rite from the Mandeans. And the Mandeans say that with a true baptism, it isn't just a physical washing, a physical purification. When you get a true Mandean baptism, what comes through the water is that Holy Spirit power that when it moves through you, it actually cleanses you on all levels, not just physically, you see, and that purification that it gives you can also open up your Gnostic wisdom and your Gnostic centers. Our belief is that Jesus received the Holy Spirit power and the power of that lineage, that Gnostic lineage, from John the Baptist during his baptism in the River Jordan. Right? It's obvious by the imagery with the lightning and a cloudless sky with the dove coming down. That's the pure Holy Spirit power that was coming into Jesus at that point, right? So it wasn't, obviously, it was not just the physical washing that Jesus received. He got a lot more. You know, he got a major transmission of power. And so that's the true baptism. Now, the Christians, one reason that the Mandeans actually say that Jesus is not one of their prophets, he's a great master of the Mandean tradition, but he's not a prophet, is because he broke a lot of rules. One rule is that you never baptize in standing water. It's always moving water, right? You never do. And there was some other things that rules that he transgressed, so he's not considered to be a prophet. John the Baptist was their last great prophet, see? And Jesus was a great master of the Mandeans, but he wasn't himself a prophet because he broke a lot of the rules. So if you want to really know the true baptismal rite, go hang out with the Mandeans in southern Iraq, because that's where it came from. That's where the Essenes got it. That's where John the Baptist got it from. See?
Were you saying that there is still a lineage from John?
Is there still lineage from John? Well, like I'm saying, that the lineage from John passed down to Jesus, to John the Apostle, actually to John and Mary Magdalene, the two apostles at the foot of the cross. From that point on, it passed down this line of John's to Hugh de Payens. Now, from Hugh de Payens, it passed down to the Templars, but it's believed that there was also a split within the Templars. And there was actually, it wasn't the Priory of Sion, as Dan Brown and some of these authors like you to believe. There really was no Priory of Sion. It was actually, there was a lineage of John's that became part of the Rosicrucian tradition, you see. And so you had a lineage of John's in Rosicrucian tradition, also a lineage of John's of the Templar tradition. And within that lineage of John's of the Rosicrucian tradition, I mean, you've got Nicholas Flamel, you've got Isaac Newton, you've got so many of the great alchemists and geniuses of medieval Europe in that line. Of course, and Leonardo da Vinci, he really was, you know, a master of that line, John number 13. And so you had two lines of John's. Well, you know, what exactly happened to the Rosicrucian line, I don't really know. What happened to the Templar line? Well, as I'm telling you, some of that John line went with the Apostolic Johannite Church, and the other of it, I believe, went with the Sinclairs, and now with the Sinclairs, as part of the IOGT, the International Order of Gnostic Templars, we are working to revive that part of the Johannite line.
Okay, so what are your current activities and the plans of the Templars then?
Well, our current activities include working to create preceptories around the world where we can give people that direct Gnostic experience.
What is a preceptory? Is that a building or a place to go?
Well, that's our center, you would call it,
okay.
Preceptory. We're also having international conferences to unite the world's religions. We believe that that's what the Templars are about. See, the Templars studied with the Sufis in the Middle East, and at that time, the Sufis were great synthesizers. They were part of the Muslim empire that had gone into India and Egypt and Persia and all over the world, and so the Sufis went to these places and then accumulated all the sacred texts and the sacred knowledge and brought it back to the Middle East and translated it into Arabic and put it into their libraries. Then they went ahead and they created these incredible synthetic mystery traditions that had Hindu yoga and Persian alchemy and Egyptian alchemy and even, you know, Greek philosophy. And, you know, the time that they were creating these incredible synthetic traditions was the time that the Templars were first formed. And so the Templars learned directly from the Sufis about how all religion is the same, how it all leads to the same place, and so, you know, why not combine all these different elements of the different traditions to make the most powerful tradition you can. And so they studied with the Druses, the Assassins, the Yazidis. These were all Sufi traditions that were synthetic, that amalgamated all these different traditions. And generally speaking, at that time, there was what's called the House of Wisdom in Cairo, and this is where Sufis got their initial training. And in this House of Wisdom, it was a mystery school of 9 degrees. It was actually sponsored and founded by the Ismaili sect. And when a Sufi advanced through the 9 degrees, then he went off and created his own tradition. It became like Hassan al-Sabbah, who founded the Assassins. He went through those 9 levels. And then the other Sufis that started the other tradition did the same thing. So anyway, the Templars learned through them about how all religion is the same and how we can create a one-world spirituality.
That's what I wanted to ask you about what's going on these days, because an amalgamation or bringing together of a lot of religions sounds what most people call New World Order-ish. New World Orderly? Is that what the Knights Templar are trying to create, a New World Order?
Well, there's a lot of different elements to that question, and of course everyone likes to blame this so-called Illuminati for everything these days, but you see, what happened was that what brought down the Templars was the monarchy. It was the monarchy of Philip of France, Philip the Fourth of France. You know, it was also Clement V, the Pope, and so they brought down the Templars in 1307. Well, you know, the secret societies that came after the Templars basically kind of took up the cause of the Templars. They wanted to further the Gnostic line and the Gnostic teachings, and they also wanted to get vengeance for the Templars. And so if you take the example of the Illuminati, they were formed in order to bring down all monarchies, all religions, basically any kind of authority on the planet that in some ways could control your thinking or control your actions. And they kind of went to an extreme, because they wanted to even take down the institution of marriage, all kinds of institution, any kind of control whatsoever they wanted to destroy.
How would they go about taking them down or destroying?
What's that?
How would they go about trying to take down or destroy? Just talk back.
Well, they decided that they were going to infiltrate or unite with the Freemasons. And then there was a big conference in Wilhelmsbad in 1782, this was in Germany, where they were able to do that. They were able to unite with the Freemasons. And, of course, Freemasons had lodges all over the world at that time. So they were going to work with the Freemasons to do this. But something happened along the way. See, starting in Wilhelmsbad, when there was this amalgamation of Freemasons and Illuminati, it was decided that the Jews could become Freemasons, or they could become part of this united organization. They had been excluded from Freemasonry and all these secret societies up until that time. So finally they were able to do that. And so what happened was that right near Wilhelmsbad down the road was Frankfurt, Germany, and that's where you had the world bankers, right? That's where you had the Rothschilds and the Oppenheimers. And so they said, okay, they count us in. And so soon what happened was that this United Illuminati Freemasonic organization, they needed to get their revolutions funded because, like I said, they wanted to bring down all authority, so they needed the French Revolution and all these other revolutions funded. And so the World Bankers, the Jews said, okay, hey, count us in, we'll fund your organization. And pretty soon what happened is that they became the richest people on the planet, and they were in the seat of control, you know. But the thing of it was, the Illuminati, when it was first formed, they actually never decided that there was going to be a one world anything or a new world order. In fact, what the Illuminati has set out to found was that a new world disorder. It had nothing to do with new world order.
It seems like throwing off authority.
Right,
more
exactly.
Anti, then building
right.
towards.
Now, the new world order, the order crept in when the Jews became part of the Illuminati organization because they were a patriarchal organization. Patriarchy is always connected to systems and institutions and so forth, because the Illuminati originally was a matriarchal institution.
It's a little thing that comes out of New Orleans sometimes.
So anyway, eventually what happened was that the Jews decided that they were going to use their affiliation with the Illuminati to take over the world, and they were going to do it via communism, of all things. And you'll find that they were behind the Russian Revolution of the Bolsheviks, and when the Bolsheviks took over power, 75% of those that were put in position of power, they were all Jews. So that plan was through Russia that they were going to infiltrate all over the world and create a one world communist society that they were going to rule over. And that's how they were going to do it. It was through communism. It wasn't actually through capitalism, as a lot of people think. It was actually through communism.
How are you guys, are you in any way related now to the Freemasons or Illuminati? Like the actual
No, I mean,
order?
You're not going to find anybody that says they're part of the Illuminati today, okay? I mean, maybe they are the descendants of the Illuminati, but they're not going to say that they're part of the Illuminati. There isn't any kind of a organization that calls itself Illuminati anymore, but they are the descendants of it, but there is no Illuminati. As far as the Freemasons go, no, we have absolutely nothing to do with the Freemasons. Freemasons received a lot of our wisdom because when we were invaded and thrown into prison, we had to find a way of hiding our mysteries. And so a lot of them we transmit into Freemasonry. And so the Freemasons have those mysteries, but they don't understand them. They don't understand anything about them. So they just blindly go through their rituals and rites without any understanding of them whatsoever, you know, which is sad, but that's the way it is.
So actually, we're down at the bottom of the hour. I was going to ask you, when we come back, actually, after our upcoming break, we'll talk a little bit about the Holy Grail, because you'd mentioned in a topics list that was something we could bring up. And whether or not this the chapel is ever going to be opened, or the crypt that's underneath the chapel, that'll be a good couple topics to finish off with here in a little bit. And I'll just remind people that this is live from Roswell. I'm Guy Malone. Mark Pinkham is our guest, and you can email a question at talktome@livefromroswell.com. And we'll be back for about another 25 minutes after these couple of commercials. Thanks for listening. Welcome back one more time to Live from Roswell. I am Guy Malone. We're broadcasting globally on the Paranormal Radio Network. And a reminder that tonight's program is sponsored in part by Alien Resistance HQ, a.k.a. alienresistance.org, featuring biblical perspectives on UFOs and abductions, as well as DVDs from past UFO conferences held here in sunny Roswell, New Mexico, and that's including the most recent Roswell UFO conference, an event that produced an 11-DVD series of over 30 lectures this past summer. And there's a Live from Roswell listener special available only on this website. The DVDs are marked at $30 off the regular price, just $49. So you can check out livefromroswell.com for a full lineup of the speakers and topics that you'll be spending about 2 months watching if you order that series. And also, if you have a product, an event, or service you'd like people to be hearing about during the program, visit livefromroswell.com and click on the link near the top that mentions audio, commercial, and banner ad opportunities. For around only a penny a listener, 40 to 50,000 people could be hearing about your tinfoil hat, product, or other thingy right now rather than these DVDs. And right now we're in the final 20 minutes or so of our conversation with Mark Pinkham, the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars. And Mark, before I forget to plug you, I know that rather than keep what you're doing as a, quote, secret society, that you encourage or allow people to become part of your organization. So tell us about the website and what might someone expect if they wanted to learn more about your order.
Thanks. The website is www.gnostictemplars.org. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C, templars.org. And if you go there, it'll tell you more about what we're up to. You can sign up for our monthly e-news newsletter. You can become an associate member of our organization online if you want, or you can also purchase our 18-lesson IOGT e-course if you want to go deeper into the mysteries of Gnostic Templarism. And we invite everybody that wants to have a deeper experience of Gnosis, wants to develop that faculty, wants to get in touch with their own inner wisdom to get involved with us. And if you want to assist the world in getting in touch with their Gnosis, their wisdom, you know, we encourage you to get involved with us as well. We have initiations in Sedona, usually one a year, and another one in Scotland. We've got this week, this year, we have one in April in Sedona, one in Scotland in July, and you can actually download an application right off the website.
So this is all online. There's no, like, blood oaths or anything.
I think that what's applicable to this program is that one of our patrons, as I mentioned, the original founder of the Gnostic tradition, I mean, he's considered to be an extraterrestrial. And I don't know, have you talked on this show about a being known as the Peacock Angel, by any chance?
Peacock
Angel.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's his name, according to the Azeti people of northern Iraq. They have the oldest tradition about him. I mean, they essentially came from India thousands of years ago, and they were one of the founders of the Sumerian civilization. And they have the original theology about the original sons of God and the Peacock Angel that led the sons of God. And basically the wisdom is that this great master merged his spirit with the spirit of the earth, and this is why he's he became the green man. And basically it's like his will reigns supreme on the planet, and I mean his will manifests through all of us that walk on the planet. And he's one reason that he did merge his spirit with the spirit of the planet, and so he could oversee the spiritual unfoldment of humanity, basically. And so he was kind of the first sacrificial son, in a way to do this. But he, in the East, he's known as the original Gnostic master, but he's also known as the original evolutionary power of Kundalini itself, the original alchemical power, because it's known in the East that in order to achieve Gnosis, you've got to transform alchemically, right? And you need to awaken that inner energy. And so, you know, it's said that he could actually call upon him to, you know, awaken that energy within you. It's amazing thing.
What have you gone through as far as your time? Because you have title now. I guess you're up a couple more notches from someone that might go on the website and just start learning from it. What type of initiations have you been through, either in Scotland or in Sedona? What happens there?
Well, all my initiations have been in Scotland, and they've been under the direction of our international Grand Prior, Ian Sinclair. So I have went to the Squire level, on to Knight Templar, on to what they call Fisher King level, and then from that on to Grand Prior. I think they're, you know, definitely the most powerful was initiation of the Grand Prior, where there was definitely a transmission of energy that was involved with that, of power that felt like, you know, apparently was passed down from that Johannite lineage. And within our own organization, you know, we try to precipitate awakening within everybody of that inner energy, so they themselves can evolve and awaken their Gnostic centers. And for people that are maybe a little bit confused about this whole idea of the peacock angels, when we were in the Middle East, when the Templars were in the Middle East, they learned about the peacock angel, but how they knew him and how they came to know him is as Saint George, because George comes from Geo, the Earth. That's the Green Man, and we used to know him as Green George. So
what about Semjaza? I'm thinking you mentioned the Book of Enoch. Semjaza is one of the main angels mentioned there.
Yeah, right.
Sons of God.
Semjaza, Azazel. I mean,
yes.
Well,
yeah.
These are essentially names for this original peacock angel. But that gets into all this Satan, Lucifer, Christ theology, which the way we know it in the West is a total distortion from the original understanding of it. The original understanding of it was that this great master, who was the peacock angel, or was this Lucifer, when he merged his spirit with the spirit of this earth, and his will manifested through all people, he fell to become the Lucifer when we fell, when the human will became the will of the ego. So he fell when we fell, because essentially what he is, he's a collective consciousness of us all. This is why that St. Paul or some of these early prophets would say, well, you know, the king of this world is the prince of the air is Lucifer, because the king of this world is the collective consciousness of all of us all. That's what rules this world, you see. It's the ego. And so he fell when we fell. But what the Azedis say is that, you know, he's being redeemed and he's once again going to reunite with his own higher self. And when he does, we all will, you see. Because he's the collective of us all. So that's
in the order.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to rewrite this legend, because it's a total distortion. It's not about duality. It's created dualistic thinking. It was a patriarchal legend, because patriarchy is all about creating duality on the planet. One way it did that is by identifying these two opposing energies of Christ and Lucifer, you see. But before that, there was only the one Son of God. That was during the goddess tradition days. Because that was before there was the polarity that was created by patriarchy. See, we're trying to take it back to the origination of the legend, which was part of the goddess tradition.
Okay, how does the... that's a weird question. I was going to say, what kind of name or anything affiliates with the goddess tradition? Is it just the Earth, Gaia, or...?
Well, it's a Neolithic time period. It's like, you know, they've written about that as... when God was a woman, right? You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's everything was part of the goddess. They've gone to Neolithic settlements and they've done excavations and they found that the goddess is manifest as a snake. You know, the power of the earth. It has a snake with the goddess with a female head. But then they've got birds that also have goddess heads. So she also ruled over the sky as well. So she was the consciousness, or the deity of the sky and the earth. I mean, she encompassed it all.
Okay, and now it's on the earth. That reminds me, just because you mentioned Lucifer, serpent, that your email address is interesting in that vein. Is it okay to share that?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, the serpent man at wherever it was. How does that relate to what you do as a Grand Prior? Just why did you choose that?
Yeah, well, the original serpents, and there was a culture of serpents around the planet pre-Christian. You'll find that the priests, kings, and head of mystery schools, they're all called serpents. Why? Because in the ancient times, serpent and the dragons, they were the wise ones. And they became wise because they awakened the serpent energy within themselves, which is that kundalini energy. And when you awaken that serpent energy, it awakens your Gnostic centers of intuition. That's when the serpent wisdom dawns. That's when you're full of the serpent wisdom. So these serpents of wisdom were actually directly related to the goddess tradition, and they were the original Gnostics, see? And so we're trying to bring back that tradition of Gnosis. And this is why I wrote the book, The Return of the Serpents of Wisdom, because the Serpents of Wisdom are coming back as the Gnostics now, and this is what we're trying to create is a revolution where, once again, this world will be populated with Gnostics full of this serpent wisdom.
And is that part of what happens if someone ascends through your order?
Well, yeah, certainly, because, you know, if you are a true Gnostic, you're a serpent of wisdom, because you become a Gnostic by awakening the serpent power. It moves through you. It activates your centers of wisdom. You see, this whole idea of the serpent on the tree, if you ask the Hindu yogis, what they say is it's a total metaphor. That serpent on the tree represents the spine. The tree is the spine, the human spine, and that serpent is the kundalini energy. And the reason that that serpent is the original teacher of Gnosis, according to the Gnostic text, is because within the human form, when that serpent kundalini awakens and moves up the spine, it opens all the Gnostic centers, and then the true wisdom dawns. It doesn't teach through words. It teaches by opening up your Gnostic centers so you have that direct download of pure intuition, and you, all the secrets are then revealed to you.
I have an email question sent in to me from Gia Scott. There's two questions. Do the Gnostic Templars perform rituals or ceremonies at Rosslyn Chapel, or is it important to them in any way?
Oh, yeah, it's very important. We had one initiation ceremony there, and we wanted to have another one this year, but they closed it down. They're closing it down in May, and it's going to be closed down for a year. They're doing some kind of internal repairs. They'd coded all the internal images with a certain kind of preserving paint, but what's happened is that paint is all cracked and crumbled, and so that bit by bit through lasers, they've got to remove all that paint, and then they've got to repaint it with some better paint that's going to better preserve those images. But, so yeah, Rosslyn Chapel is extremely important to us. I mean, that's kind of our mecca, and see, the Sinclairs don't own or don't have possession of Rosslyn Chapel right now, or we would have a lot more rights there. You see, the thing is, about five generations back, the Sinclairs lost the rights to Rosslyn Chapel because there was only a female heir in the line, and she married into the Erskine clan. So the Earl of Rosslyn is an Erskine, Peter Sinclair Erskine, and he couldn't care less about going into the crypt, or he couldn't care less about the Templars or any of this stuff. But the Sinclairs are in active negotiation to get back Rosslyn Chapel, and it looks like, according to Earl Malcolm Sinclair, the chief of Clan Sinclair today, that they're close to doing that. That the negotiations are close for the Sinclairs to actually retake Rosslyn Chapel, because basically, what's in Rosslyn Chapel is Sinclair history. It's not Erskine history. In fact, they say that there's 20 Sinclairs entombed in the crypt in Rosslyn Chapel in full knighted armor. So it's basically the mausoleum of the Sinclairs. So, yes, most definitely, as soon as the Sinclairs can take back Rosslyn Chapel, we're going to have a lot of rituals there, and, you know, we expect to get into that crypt as fast as we can.
Yeah, that was the question we were going to bring up. Is that crypt planned to be opened?
Yeah, we're going to retrieve those documents and those treasures just as soon as we can. As soon as the Sinclairs can take back the chapel, we're going to go down there. Right now, Peter Sinclair Erskine, he couldn't care less about going down there because, like I said, it's Sinclair history. But also, I mean, he's making money hand over fist thanks to Da Vinci Code and the Hiram Key and some of these books. So he doesn't really care about going down. He's done less about retrieving the treasures of the mysteries of Roslyn Chapel than any earl that has been in possession of Roslyn Chapel ever. You know, so he couldn't care less about it.
Do they just charge money to enter it, or?
Oh yeah, it's like £7. I think it was like $15 now.
Oh, just to walk into the building and.
Uh huh.
And he's sitting on top of a crypt that he could open but isn't.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's weird.
Well, you know, you also have to get special permission from Sinclair. Historical Scotland, because it's on the historical register. You know, so you can't, even if you were Earl of Roslyn, you can't just open up the crypt anytime you want. You've got to get special permission. But I don't think it would be any problem to get permission once we reclaim the chapel. But because you know, Andrew Sinclair also already got permission back in the 90s, and for a brief moment he actually went down into the crypt. You know, so this is a little known truth. He went down into the crypt. He actually took up some of the floor panels in Roslyn Chapel, went down into the crypt, and he found some things. He found some skulls. Of course, the Templars are famous for skulls. And found a few other things. And then he went a little bit further, and then he encountered a big block wall. Well, you know, it couldn't go any further. That was the end of his work. That was it. Because then, of course, you have to get special permission to break down the block wall. And, you know, that's next to impossible to do, because that's liable to totally screw up the foundations of the building, you know. But the reason he went down there originally, because he found a round scan showing there was a staircase there, you know. So he picked up the panel that was right above the staircase and went right down. Well, we know that there's other staircases, and so the next time we'll just go to a different staircase. And, in fact, where the really treasures are supposed to be isn't a wholly different part of the crypt anyway. You know, it's actually right underneath what they call a keystone. And right underneath the keystone in Roslyn Chapel, the columns there make a perfect Star of David, and it's believed that right underneath there is where the treasures are kept. See?
But you might bring the whole building down if you knock down the wrong foundation.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Trying to get to the crypt.
But, you know, it's actually been proven in a lot of ways that Roslyn Chapel was built to be a model of Solomon's Temple, which was really Hiram's Temple, because that's what the Templars studied when they were in the Holy Land. And so basically what the Templars did is that they took those treasures out of Herod's Temple, or what they call Solomon's Temple, took it back up into Scotland, and then another Solomon's Temple was made to hold them. And they were put in exactly the same place as they had been originally in the Holy Land, see?
You know, I got like just 2 minutes, I think, here. One of the things we were going to talk about at the other break was what you believe about the Holy Grail.
Right, well...
2 minutes, probably.
Okay, well, you know, what you find out is it's not one thing. It's as many things. And we conveniently forgot all the Grail texts that had written in the 13th, 14th century that talked about many forms of the Holy Grail. And these texts were actually written by Templars themselves. So to say that it's just one thing, is it the body of Mary Magdalene, or it's just a cup, or whatever, it's ridiculous. All you have to do is study the Grail text to find that's totally not true. And what you find if you study the Grail text is that there's kind of, what makes something a Grail is it has Grailism. I mean, it has a power frequency attached to it, so that if you were to drink from a cup that had that frequency, then that liquid that entered your body would initiate the process of alchemical unfoldment. I mean, all the relics of the Passion, the crown of thorns, the spear of Longinus, the holy shroud, they were all ascribed powers of a Holy Grail. Because why? Because they were saturated with the power that emanated from Jesus. You know? That's how they became Holy Grail. So if you were to hold any of those articles, the energy of that article is saturated with would move within you, which is the Holy Spirit power to activate your own inner kundalini, initiate your power of alchemical enfoldment. So it's a frequency, it's an energy that an object has, and that energy was actually infused into it by a great master who himself was full of that energy. See?
So there are many of these
There's many. In fact, the Holy Grails existed 1,000 years before Jesus was even born.
There are others. Thank you. Yeah, we're at the break time before we begin another program on Paranormal Radio Network. I'll give it again. Your site is GnosticTemplars.org.
That's right.
Okay. And it's linked from live from Roswell.com for any that are spelling challenged or haven't had a chance. We're wrapping up in the last minute here of live from Roswell.com. We appreciate you listeners for listening and interacting with us, and I appreciate you, Mark, for coming on and telling us about it.
Thank you very much. I'd like to come back sometime, maybe, huh?
Maybe so. Especially, hey, if you get permission to open the crypt, can I bring a video camera and do it with you?
No promises, but we'll see.
Okay, well, I would love to do that. same thing. All right, thanks very much for joining us, and thanks again, folks.
Thank you.
From Roswell. Good night, everybody. Thank you.